The Afterlife, Deathbed Visions. That's our next topic with Carla Wills Brandon next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Carla Wills Brandon back with us, a licensed marriage and family therapist, author of several books discussing topics ranging from relationships, addiction and recovery to grief and afterlife research. Of course, Carla received her undergraduate degree in psychology at California State University at Fresno, and then went on to receive a master's degree in clinical psychology from the California School of Professional Psychology in Fresno as well. Her books include Heavenly Hugs, One Last Hug Before I Go, A Glimpse of Heaven. Carla, welcome back to the program. It's been a while.
Hey, George, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I've got a little frog voice today, Carla, but it's on the downhill spiral now, which is good.
Ah, you need some slippery elm.
That would work. I've got some.
You do? Well, you know, go ahead and start using it.
Well, now, what's the best way to take it?
Well, you can take it in a lozenge form or tea. I prefer actually the lozenge form because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't like taste like something that you want to use on a regular basis.
Yeah, no,
but
exactly.
It works wonderful. So, we have that in our house, and my boys seem to think that their mother is crazy because she's been into all this alternative health stuff forever. And I look at them and I say, well, look at how healthy you are. Leave me alone.
How did you get involved in looking at stories of the afterlife?
Well, I was a real chicken for years because I grew up in a family where my grandfather on my mother's side had witnessed UFOs in California in the 40s. And so he and I would sit in the backyard in California waiting to see if anything would manifest in the skies. And it wasn't really talked about. We just did it. And then my mother was very into a lot of this stuff, and there were mediumistic abilities. I like to call it sensitive.
Yeah.
Person who's a sensitive. But she was very sensitive, and she could pick things up. But, you know, she had tons of books under her bed about all this stuff. And, of course, being the nosy person that I was when I was really young, I found them all and I started reading them all. And so when I had my first experiences, I was really, really young. My mom had passed. And right before she passed, I had gone to a Sly and the Family Stone concert with a bunch of goofy girlfriends. We thought we were so cute. And so, anyway, Sly was late as usual because, you know, he is known for imbibing a little bit. And I suddenly felt really sick. It was really hot. It was in the valley. And so I saw an ambulance, and I decided, oh, man, I'm going to go lay down in that ambulance. And so that's exactly what I did.
Jeez.
And then when I woke up and went home, I found out that the time I crawled into that ambulance, my mother was being loaded up into an ambulance and taken to the hospital. That's called an empathetic departing vision, where we can be in different locations. One person can be, you know, one California and love someone who's in New York, and the one in California starts feeling really, really sick, and they're, you know, they know they're healthy, and they don't understand why they feel like this. And then they realize that their best friend or their relative was having a heart attack at the exact moment they were feeling so sick.
But you don't realize that at that moment, do you?
No, not until the phone call comes or the email or text comes, and there's this revelation. Wow, you know, I was feeling horrible. I was feeling sick and sweaty and like I was going to pass out. And one person I know actually had a deathbed vision with his wife as she was passing. And so what happened was he traveled with her to the other side, but was not allowed to continue with her. So he got to experience what it was like for her to pass and then experience what it was like for her to move on, but then was told it wasn't his time.
They turned him back, I guess, huh?
Well, what happens is that when it's not your time, it's just not your time. I had a near-death experience and was really told very clearly it was not my time.
What had happened to your mother eventually?
Well, my mother, what happened is shortly after that, she passed away, and again, I had another departing vision. She came by, and I had a sense. I knew intuitively that she had moved on. Physically, she wasn't here anymore. And not only did I have that experience, but two family friends and two other relatives, all at the same time, we all in very different locations, knew that my mom had, she had come by and touched us in some way, but that she had moved on. Now, here's the sad thing. Now, at that time, I was just 16, but here's the really sad thing. All of us, all five of us, none of us talked to the other for years, decades.
Why not?
Because it's not, we still can't talk about this stuff. We're not supposed to talk about this stuff. It's almost as if we do say anything about having these experiences, what people say to me is, folks look at me like I'm cracked. They look at me like I'm nuts. And so, you know, our kids are being raised with the idea that I see so many kids who are death phobic. It's really, really sad. And it's because their parents are death phobic. And so I really do believe that a lot of societal things that are going on right now really have an, are a need about to be remembered, known, seen, not forgotten, not seen as invisible because of this huge fear of physical death that so many people have.
I would say most people, Carla, are afraid of dying. Most
yes.
people. And it's probably pretty natural, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Being with people who have passed on, it's been fascinating for me. There was this one woman who was from Germany, and she had been put in a camp when she was 12 years of age. And so when she began to pass, she started having these really dramatic conversations in German. And her husband said to me, what do I do? She seems really upset. And I said, well, talk to her in German. Because if we have an original tongue, French, Spanish, whatever, what will happen when it gets close to passing, if we have a visible departing vision, what we will do is we will start talking in that tongue. And so her original tongue was German. And so when he began talking to her, he learned that she was having a lot of deep conversations with people from way back when. She had been a diehard, uber-liberal lawyer who would look and say, but also I'm an atheist, and I'm a hardcore atheist. And we'd say, yes, you're an atheist. And I would think to myself, one day, one day. And it happened. It happened. She had this marvelous departing vision before she passed on. And I, you know, my mother-in-law, who was Polish, she returned to her native tongue, and she was able to have conversations with her mother, who died in the gas chambers, and her father, who was locked up in a gulag. So my another relative of mine passed away not that long ago, and she was a Holocaust survivor. And she, too, started talking to relatives who had passed in the Holocaust, and she was talking in Polish. So this kind of stuff, people just don't talk about it. In the medical community, it's frightening the way they treat these things. So,
well, they think it's crazy, don't they?
Huh?
They think it's crazy, don't they?
Well, what they want to do is they want to hop up the medications. You know, that's always my biggest complaint whenever I talk about this topic. When somebody is actually feeling better and more at peace because they've had one of these experiences, and all concerns about death and dying are removed, and they even may describe where it is they're going and who it is they're seeing who has departed before them. And so there's this sense, it's just a sense of peace that overcomes them. And so medical people will look at that as we need more medication, or they're hallucinating, or it's the dying brain. That's always my favorite. That was disproven decades ago. So in our society, in medical situations, medical schools, they just don't talk about this stuff.
Carla, you spent some time checking into the afterlife in England. How come? What was that?
Because my own sensitivities were running me. they're absolutely running me. And so I had ignored them pretty much for the majority of my life. And in my younger years, I tried to talk to some of my peers about it, and they just, you know, nixnoid, no. That was the message I got. And so I kept trying to tuck it away and tuck it away and tuck it away, even with my own history in my family.
Mm-hmm.
And then I began hearing about these experiences from the clients I was working with. And so that's when I started really investigating this stuff, and started, you know, researching accounts from all around the world. But I was still pretty chicken about going public with it. And so my first batches of books, before the ones that you mentioned, didn't have anything to do with departing visions.
Ah.
Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who wrote the first, you know, modern-day book on death and dying.
Yeah, she and Raymond Moody kind of paved the way.
They did. But do you know that she had in that book, she had a whole chapter devoted to children's departing visions? She would sit at the bedside of children and listen to them and write down their accounts. Well, she was told by her publisher not to put that in that book because she would lose credibility. And that's the way it was just maybe 20 years ago for people who were just investigating this stuff. Well, when it hits home and your own kid starts talking to you about seeing a guide that's has come to take grandpa away, and they describe this guide and they feel very natural and safe and like, why am I so stupid? Why don't I realize this? Then I really, I had to do something. I really did. And so I had to take a look at how I really didn't have any development myself, none. Now, your audience needs to know I don't have a shingle hung out saying medium,
mm-hmm.
medium at
right.
large.
I'll do readings for you. You don't do that.
Yeah, I'll do it for friends and family, but you know, I just, and sometimes the deceased will show up in my work when I'm working with a client. But the Texas Licensing Board would definitely yank my licenses if I started doing that in that capacity. But I really had to start taking a look at, here are all these people who come to me, and I'm the first person who hears their account. Whether it's a dinner party or it's a rock concert, it's a family gathering, it's like, at least every other day, somebody is approaching me and saying, I heard through the grapevine that you know something about this, and I haven't told anybody anything about how my mother was preparing to pass and how all of a sudden she said the whole family that was on the other side was here, and she got mad at me because I wasn't creating a party for everybody. And all the relatives who were on this side heard this from her, witnessed the same thing, and looked at each other and said, what on earth is she talking about? And, of course, she retreated to the language of her origin also when she was talking. But I received contact from several of her children about this. So they have this sort of information, Hollywood style, on television or in movies. And some of it is pretty inaccurate, the way they present it. But, and there are some people out there who, they have some fame and they have some acknowledgement, and people have heard of them before. And they will say a few things, but it's not common cocktail party talk. And so people, when they first witness this with a loved one, it usually scares them. But for me, I was sensing things, seeing things, hearing things, and smelling things. And I finally decided that I really needed to do something about this. So I went out to Arthur Findlay College a bunch of times, which is a college outside of London. It's in Stansted, and it is a wonderful place. I mean, it's a good place to go get right-sized if one has these sorts of experiences and doesn't know what to do with them.
And they know, they understand it.
They understand it. And so I got a mentor after a number of visitations there, and then went to Torquay, England, which is on the coast I think it's on the east side, lower east side on the coast, and went out there and met a number of wonderful English individuals who were like me, but they were so much more progressed. They were so natural with it, and it, you know, they did little mini readings in their tea rooms with tea and biscuits. They were just wonderful. I loved them. And so I did that for a number of years. And so today I still have a mentor because I have a lot to learn. And some of the things that come up for me, I get kind of overwhelmed still sometimes with some of the things that Spirit pushes forward. And so for anybody out there who feels like they have sensitivities, they are more than welcome to get in contact with me, and I can direct them towards some information that might help them out a little bit.
You are convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that the other side exists and there's something very different about it, aren't you?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. There was a woman who came to see me, and actually she and two others came, and I think they were Unity ministers, if I remember correctly.
Humans, you mean? Alive people who are alive, you're talking about.
Yeah, these are. Sometimes I get confused, George. But they came over, and one woman really wanted to talk to me, and suddenly I had this feeling of a loved one of hers being shot in the chest. And I had a sense that it was her son. And so I said something to her about this, and she said, yes, that was my son. And so those sorts of experiences for me are things that I need to debrief with my mentor still. And I think that it's kind of like, I believe most people should have somebody special that they can go to when they have questions about life that they don't have the answers to. And so I've been doing that now for quite a while, too. And I'm kind of, sometimes some of the stuff that I see in the United States makes me sad, because I think that there are some wonderful individuals who are very sensitive. But then there are others who, I've sent clients to go see these people, and all they get are advertisements for their books and tape. And
that's
so
it.
They walk out.
They're frustrated, aren't they?
Yeah, I had a guy who had AIDS. He had AIDS, and I've had a couple of folks who've had terminal illnesses, and I try to send them somewhere where I think they'll get some help, and I made the mistake of suggesting this one individual, and this person came back, and they were very upset and very angry. So if somebody is looking for somebody like that, shop around, look around. A lot of time I'm like a radio channel when that stuff happens, and sometimes I can tune in and sometimes I can't. And I think that's the way it is with most people, because it's a vibrational thing. But the deathbed vision is a pretty different thing.
Is it common among those who are dying?
I think it's common, but what I have received are I've received contact from people who are in the process of dying, and they've tried to talk about it to somebody, and they've been blown off.
Why?
Because they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear it. They would rather see it be a dysfunction created by the brain, or lack of oxygen, or as a consequence to an illness or a disease.
Hold on, Carla. We're going to come back right after this break and talk more about your work. Heavenly Hugs. One last hug before I go, and a glimpse of heaven. George Norrie back with you. Carla Wills Brandon with us. Carla, what do you believe the soul is? What's its purpose?
Well, I'm doing a new book, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. For a long time, there was discussion that Jews don't believe in the afterlife. Well, that's poppycock. As far back, thousands of years ago, people have talked about some essence of soul. They may have called it different names, But going back through ancient history and looking at all of these descriptions, they match up so succinctly with some of the things that are said today. Like it's a light, shards of glass. It's like shards of glass. That's a real Kabbalistic sort of presentation. That it's an energy level, but it's been described as something else as opposed to an energy level, different vibration. That it's that essence of us that really what we're doing is we are experiencing life and co-creating with some form of universal greater power.
Mm-hmm.
And so that works for me.
Is that greater power what we would call God?
Some people call it God. Some people have a real hard time with that word. Some people like to call it an energy. People who are involved in physics have words for it. Different religions have different words, but the description is the same from religion to religion. In my last book, I looked at, some Middle Eastern viewpoints, and I looked at some accounts from antiquity, and I looked at some accounts from somewhere else. I can't remember, but I looked at a lot. But, you know, what I discovered was that the wording may be a little bit differently, but it's the same thing.
It's very similar.
That's been repeated time and over and time and over and time again. And so people might, you know, there are some terms that have been around forever, but then there are other terms that have surfaced that people feel more comfortable with. Maybe they've had a bad rap with religion. So I decided to do this book because I think that before the Holocaust, there was real involvement in religion, and there was a mystical side within the religion that looked at concepts like the soul and universal power and sensitivities and all that stuff. And so I think that with the Holocaust, people were crushed. I know people in my family and my husband's family, it was the comment that we heard was, why would God do this to us? And so anytime there's a grief issue of any sort of loss, we have to go through this process of rejecting things that used to make, that we depended on, that gave us that safe feeling. And so in this instance, how can somebody watch their relatives being taken away in cattle carts? Or for me, hearing the stories of the relatives who were taken off, or spending so much time with my husband's family with tattoos on their arms. There is an understanding why it's difficult for them to even want to look at the concept of a soul. My mother-in-law basically said to me when I wrote my second book on this topic, she said, first book, she said, that's superstitious nonsense. And then the second book, she said, I don't think I'm spiritual enough to read it. And so having worked with first and second and third generation, the feelings of trauma within our own families, the emotions can be passed on down from one generation to the next. And so that's why I think we're so stuck right now. We got into the mechanical age, and people are all about looking at motors and engines and making things work and tinkering. And then, of course, you did have a whole slew of mediums during the Victorian age who were proven out to be real frauds. And so that puts a damper on any party, so nobody's going to take a look at that. And so when I talk to people, that's one of the things that we work on if they have a huge, huge loss. And they come in, and they're typically very angry with any concept of God. They think the soul is a myth. And it really, it's about anger. It's about anger, about feeling as though they were abandoned, let down. They lost somebody very close to them. In our society, it is not okay to grieve. You're supposed to have the funeral, have the relatives over, and then you're supposed to pull yourself together up by your bootstraps and go on with life, which is not the way it works. And so people when they realize that there are all these different ideas surrounding the concept of God or a higher power, a universal power, or a lot of different ideas regarding the soul, it's like they don't feel stuck in dogma. And so a lot of us have watched our grandparents or great-grandparents or even our parents either get stuck in dogma or throw everything out the window. And so people just decide, okay, so maybe I will go to church, synagogue, temple. I'll go, and I like the traditions, and I like my friends there. But I just can't. I've heard this from ministers, by the way. I just can't buy these concepts of afterlife, of soul, spirit. I just can't buy it. And that's very, very prevalent in our society. So there are those individuals who are very extreme with religion. And I think the last time I was on your show, I talked about the stages of faith. And this isn't me originally, but I picked it up from somebody else, that the first stage is you go to synagogue, temple, whatever, because your parents tell you you have to go.
Right. That's how you start.
That's how you start. And then you discover there are really good cookies there.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. And then you realize that you like some of the people there. And so stage two, you begin to learn about the structure of the faith, the structure of the religion, belief system. Atheism is a philosophy and a belief system. So if you're raised by parents who are atheists, there's going to still be this dogma. I don't care what anybody says. And then third stage actually is a type of agnostic thinking. It's about questioning. So my boys love telling me, you're a weirdo, Mom. We're agnostics. You know, it's kind of like, ha, ha, we're agnostics. And so I don't say to them, well, that's exactly where you're supposed to be.
At least they're not atheists, right?
Well, if they're really in a mood, they like to tell me they're atheists. One time one of them said that, and I said, do you know what an atheist is? But I think a lot of the younger generation right now, that's where they're at, is that, and it's part of separation, it's part of rejecting the generation before us. But then if this happens in a healthy progression, we come to terms with the fact that there is something much greater than us, and we don't even have to define it. We just have to know that it's there.
Carla, how do we know that the brain doesn't react as we get close to dying, and it just does these weird things, creates these images, and so we get the perception of an afterlife?
Okay. I had somebody in about a year ago who was hopped up on meth. And they were talking to Jesus, and they were talking to God, and they were, you know, they were hallucinating. I mean, pure hallucination. Mm-hmm. And so when I talk to people who are in, you know, a hallucinatory state or some sort of psychosis or a manic bipolar state, what I hear different stories. So my job is to step into their story and to help them find a way to make peace with their story or to walk out of their story of darkness, because usually that's what it is, and to come up with ways where they can, with peace, find something that works for them. So it's very different from person to person. So when I have somebody who's in a manic phase and they come in and they're bouncing off the wall and they're going here and they're going there, and
yeah.
And it's very grandiose, and they got the Savior thing going on. That is going to be different from the person maybe who I saw last week. When I talk to people who have departing visions, they may even speak different languages, have religion, not have religion, but they're gonna share a similar account, and the account is going to be that there's somebody who is there with them, who has preceded them in physical death, who they feel very excited, they feel very comfortable, like this is a good thing. Sometimes people do have scary moments when they have these experiences.
What do you mean by scary?
Well, they can, like, I remember one woman, she said, "Who is that man? What's he doing in my room? Why is he here? I don't know why he's here." And so she fought and fought and fought and fought. And she had a horrible fear of death and dying. She had a lot of unresolved grief. And so the experience for her was like it took being on her deathbed to get to a place where she could find some peace. Because eventually she determined that this was some relative who had come to help escort her to a place on this hill where the rest of the relatives were.
Jeez.
But at first she was, like, really scared. And so people don't like to talk about that who are in my field. There are some who will talk about it. But it does occur where people are scared. Where someone was talking about some angel with great big giant wings, and it was kind of overwhelming for them and kind of scary. And then when we got to the other side of work, which definitely took a few months, and it's not my job to tell them what to believe. My job is to sit and listen and to validate their accounts based on research, the experience of others. I sometimes talk about my experiences.
Do you offer opinion?
Huh?
Do you offer opinion?
I do, yes.
Okay.
But I'm cautious because it's their journey. So my job is to give them some tools to make the trip and to get to where they need to get with regard to all this stuff. So these people who have these departing visions, it's consistent, the ones who are passing. They are greeted by somebody who has gone before them. Some of them have what's called the deathbed stare. Right now, there is a woman who is preparing to pass. And I asked recently her son, "Have you noticed that she's staring at any particular part of the room?" And he said, "Well, actually, yes. She stares at one corner in the room." And so I said to him, "Have you ever asked her what it is she's looking at?" So that's the sort of information I'm supposed to provide for individuals.
Carla, you deal with a lot of people with grief, of course, and are they able to pull themselves out of it?
Well, see, here's the sad thing. I get people who have gone to get help for their grief, and there are some really great clinicians out there. I'm not going to say there aren't. But there are some out there, they haven't done their own work. They haven't even grieved their own losses. So how on earth are they going to help somebody who's in grief? And so these people, they come in. I heard something yesterday that I was just baffled by. I couldn't believe that a clinician would say that to a client about the grief process. Actually mortified. And that person was very surprised when I said, "That's really not the way it works. Your job is to embrace all of your feelings, have all your feelings, your anger, your fear, disappointment, the dream of what was to come and didn't because of this passing. This is kind of the way it works." And so there's a lot of clinicians use writing, but in my situation, every once in a while, the deceased pop in. Now, I can't say to the person sitting there, "Oh, by the way, I got your grandfather here." Because, as I said, my licenses would get yanked. But what I can do is I can talk to that person on the other side and just get some information from them. And then I can go in between the two, but I can do it in a way where it's not going to scare the client or be disrespectful to the client. But what I can do is I can give them some tools so that they themselves can learn how to make that kind of contact.
Carla, I have a... Go ahead, I'll let you finish up, then I have a question for you.
But my job, as I said, I think that a lot of people have these experiences and they just don't know where to turn. Religion doesn't often offer us solutions, even though within their religious tradition, there's tons of it, tons of it. All they have to do is go read the literature.
That's right.
And you can find it. So my job is to basically provide the information, help them through their grief, because it's really hard to have these experiences and be able to embrace them if we still have grief going on.
I have conflicting guests who say there is a hell or there isn't a hell. What's your take?
My take is that we go where we're going to go. So there are some people who are very, very stubborn. So as a sensitive in sharing information with people who have come to me for that specific thing, I have seen some people who are stuck. They're stuck. And they're bound and determined to stay in that thought pattern. And then there are others who it's like they've done a lot of work here. They've worked on maybe addictions or losses, or but they have, you know, they've been of service, but they've, you know, they have really, they've allowed themselves to spiritually evolve on this plane. And so that evolution continues when they cross over. Sitting on a cloud, playing a harp, or getting hit on the head by the good fairy. It's, you know, we continue the journey. We take ourselves to the other side.
Let's talk more when we come back, and we'll take phone calls, questions, and stories next.